improvised thoughts, music, and talk about music with your host, B.G. Adair.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is B.G. Adair with Improvised Thoughts, and I'm very, very happy to have as my guest this evening, Mr. Mose Allison.
How are you?
It's nice to meet you after all these years, and nice to have you on our show.
Yeah, thank you.
And it's really nice to put, although I've seen you in person several times, it's really nice to see an up-close face that I can put with the music. And it's kind of fun to hear a Southern accent again.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I got one.
And yes, you do. So do we all in this part of the country. But the Mississippi and Louisiana accents are more
melodious. Yeah, you never lose it. I've never lost it. Now, some people, actually, there are people who lose it. I don't know why, but.
Yeah, I don't know why either, but they do. We're going to start out by playing a piece from my backyard album. And this, as I remember, is a John Loudermilk tune.
Right,
is
yeah.
That? Yeah. This is called, you call it jogging, but I call it running around.
You say it's the best release that you've ever found. You say that you're trying to lose weight, but you ain't lost a pound. While you're out there with your friend, I'm home feeding the kids again. You call it jogging, but I call it running around. You call it jogging, but I call it running around. Them soles on your running shoes ain't wearing down. Friends all smile and agree, yes, she's running, definitely. You call it jogging, but I call it running around. Call it jogging, but I call it running around. You're dragging that silly old towel all over town. You come in with your hair all wet, smelling like shampoo instead of sweat. You call it jogging, but I call it running around. You call it jogging, but I call it running around. I do believe you're playing me for a clown. Somebody saw you getting out of a car. When did a runner ever smoke a cigar? You call it jogging, but I call it running around.
I and John Loudermilk go back a ways. I used to do a lot of demos for him. Did you meet him through this tune, or have you known him a long time?
No, I met him last time I was here. I've talked to him a couple of times, but the way I got that song, a guy named Philippe Ruault, who's French.
No kidding.
this is one of those long way around things. But anyhow, Philippe knew about John D. Loudermilk. Mm-hmm. He spent a lot of time in New Orleans. He's a real aficionado of American music and jazz and blues and so forth and country. He knows a lot about country and all everything. So he told me that John had written a song with that title, and man, right away I said, "Oh, I gotta have that!" You know. So it took me a long time to track it down, and finally Philippe, I don't know how he happened to be down here, and he saw John or something, and he got a demo of it.
Mm-hmm.
So from John's demo, I worked out my version, and that's how I recorded it. So
yeah.
That's the way it came about. But that's such a great line, you know.
You know, it's what occurs to me is that it sounds like a Mose Allison line.
Well, that's a lot of people think it's mine. You know, I always identify it as John Loudermilk's, but yeah, I always look for tunes that are in my area there, but somebody else did. Mm-hmm. So it suits my repertoire real good.
Yeah, it even rhythmically it feels like something that you could have written yourself. Do you think that's part of? Do you think that sort of amalgamation of styles that you have in your music and that John D. Loudermilk has in his songwriting and things is part of growing up in the South and mixing all these things up?
Oh, I think so. Sure, you know it's Southern primarily, although there are a lot of other elements. And not necessarily in that particular cut, but in some of the things I do, there are a lot of elements that aren't Southern, but the overall scheme of things is still Southern music. You know, it's based on the Southern feel, the Southern rhythm, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested to hear who influenced you, because I see your influence on younger musicians as we go along. So I'd like to go back maybe and hear who.
Yeah.
Who you listened to when you were coming up?
Well, I started out playing boogie-woogie, you know. After elementary music lessons, I quit taking music and didn't learn to read very well, and I started picking out boogie-woogie and blues stuff. When I was a kid, I used to play at parties, and I would play things that I would hear on the jukeboxes around Tippo, Mississippi, like "She Let Me Play With Your Poodle," and "She Wants to Sell My Monkey." You know, I thought, man, that tune is probably lost forever, and damned if B.B. King didn't play it on the Tonight Show.
Right.
She Wants to Sell My Monkey. Man, it knocked me out when I heard it. And there were a few things like that. And so then I started listening to Nat King Cole when he had the trio back in the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And Errol Garner, those were my early heroes. And as far as singing goes, I started out listening to people like Nat King Cole and Fats Waller and Louis Jordan,
and as
well as the blues people. And later on, one of the major influences on my vocal style was Percy Mayfield, Louisiana blues singer.
Well, I hear I hear your influence in younger singers like Lyle Lovett, for example, comes to mind. The lyric, that sort of clear-eyed take on what's going on in the world that comes through the lyric that he's doing these days seems to me to come from people like you.
Yeah, well, I like to call it realism.
There you go.
it's ironic and satirical to the most part, but I think it's the idea is you try to get some sort of truth out of it, you know.
Yeah, and the truth seems to be, I've heard you say this on other shows, that that you deal with songs that have to do with your own area, your own space. But in general, you make the point for universal mankind by saying this happened to Mose or this is what Mose thinks.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you go from proceed from the specific to the general. That's sort of the way it works, yeah.
Yeah. I think we should play another tune and we get into talking about what that tune is talking about, because I want to hear all about this. This is a tune called Getting Paid Waltz, and why don't you set it up for us and tell us which album it's from?
Well, that's just, you know, it's that was sort of started out as a joke. Several of my tunes start out as a joke, you know. And when you were hanging around waiting to get paid in a nightclub sometimes, you know, that's what musician friends and I used to refer to that as the Getting Paid Waltz. So I just decided, well, I might as well write a song for the occasion, and that's what happened.
All right. So here's the Getting Paid Waltz.
I'm doing the getting paid waltz. I'm doing the getting paid waltz. All night long he was hanging around. Now that I need him, he's not to be found. All other people are homeward bound, and I'm doing the getting paid waltz. I'm sitting here sipping this beer. I'm sitting around sipping this beer. The waitress is all through counting her take. They finally got rid of the resident plate. I'm having trouble staying awake, and I'm doing the getting paid waltz. getting paid, boss. I'm doing the getting paid, boss. I could get up and walk out in a huff, but I can't take a chance on him calling my bluff. When I finally get straight, it is never enough, and I'm doing the getting paid, boss. The tradition of getting paid ball.
I would say that everybody I know has done the getting paid waltz.
Yeah, I think so. And a lot of people who aren't musicians.
That's true. Lining up at the window and waiting for the man who right. seems to have gone to get some coffee or something.
Yeah, right.
Tell me a little bit about all the kinds of places you've... But we know that you've had a long career in clubs and on record and everything, but doing the getting paid waltz is something that you probably had to do more of at the front of your career now than you do now.
Yeah.
So let's hear back... Some of that early stuff.
Well, I played, I started out playing down south, you know, in Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas, in honky-tonks and roadhouses and lounges and so forth. And so that was primarily the kind of work I did, you know, for the first several years. And I went out to Denver, spent a couple of years, and spent about a year and a half in Denver working around there. But the rest of it was in the south, and... sort of hand to mouth, you know. We'd go to a town. I had a couple of pals that liked to play, and we'd go to a place, say like Dallas or something, and just try to see if we could get a job somewhere. We'd go somewhere and play cheap, you know. And my wife would try to get a day job, and we'd get a furnished apartment, and we'd stay there as long as the work held up, and then move on from that, you know, somewhere else. So it was sort of pretty much like gypsies there for the first few years, you know.
Mm-hmm. But you were getting you were getting an underground even then. People, I can remember, without bringing dates into it too much, I can remember when I first got out of graduate school and moved to Nashville. I was listening to a lot of Mose Allison at that point, and you were already on record. And
I was
very
already
well
recording then. Yeah, I made first record. I went to New York in '56. I had been to New York once before in '51, but it was a little too much for me. I couldn't bring myself to stay there at the time, because I got up there in '51 and all these jazz stars that I'd been reading about in the magazines were all hanging around on the corner looking,
right.
trying to borrow,
trying to get a job.
So I had to go back and readjust myself to that. But by the time I spent a few more years down south, traveling around, playing everything, then I was ready. I got myself ready to go back, and I saved a few bucks and went back to New York in '56, and I was able to get a record deal in '57.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I started recording.
That would be the record that was called Mose Allison Sings.
No, Backcountry Suite was
Backcountry
the first
Suite
one.
Was the first one.
Mose Allison Sings was a reissue of all the vocals from the first five Prestige albums.
Okay. Yeah. I think Mose Allison Sings is the first one that I got,
right?
Because I remember hearing all those hits.
Well,
but
tell me about
Backcountry Suite.
Well, Backcountry Suite was just a collection of tunes that I had written when I was down south that was intended to depict the southern tone and quality and all that, and that was one of the things. It was sort of like my primer.
Mm-hmm.
That's like, this is where I start from right here, you know, and it had the elements of church music and blues and the whole thing, and it's meant to depict and musically the Mississippi Delta scene.
Did you feel political back then? A lot of your music has some very political overtones.
Right. Well, you know, in a way, everything's political.
Yeah.
And but I'm not political in the sense that I go out and and try to get something done for a certain person or a certain party. Mm-hmm. I approach it as just as an individual who's just looking at the scene and trying to come up with, make sense of it in some sort of way. And it usually winds up to be political, you know, because I do feel strongly about a lot of things that are going on, and it usually comes out in the music. Mm-hmm. So there is a political side to it, but I don't start out to be political or to write a tune that will favor somebody or one system over another one or something like mm-hmm. that. You know, it's just the way it, I consider myself as a sort of an observer and who's just trying to, a sensible, hopefully reasonable observer that's mm-hmm. trying to sort it out.
Mm-hmm. You had a background. You have a background in English literature,
right?
As I understand, you have a degree in English literature. What did you plan to do when you were in college? Were you always going to be a musician, or did you plan to teach?
I never planned to do anything.
I like that.
I just sort of went along, and you know, I assumed that as long as I could get jobs playing music, I would do that. And it just turned out I missed the graduation ceremonies at LSU because I had a job in Jackson, Mississippi in a honky-tonk. So it just sort of came about, and little by little, and I got started playing, and I was able to scrape by, you know, for, mm-hmm. so until I could get to where I could make a living, you know, a few years later when I got to New York, started recording everything.
Well, you don't seem to have missed the English lit career much. You seem to have taken the English lit sort of sensibility and put it into your songs.
It's helped me. I still read a lot. You know, I always like to read.
Yeah,
I read all the time.
That's very evident.
And there's been a lot of the songs I've done were influenced, sometimes inspired by literature, you know, mm-hmm. things I read.
A person that comes to mind, not stylistically, but just the lyric content and what he's done for American music, I guess, the person that comes to mind is Pete Seeger, and I mm-hmm. see you as a kind of jazz Pete Seeger in some ways.
Yeah, I admire Pete Seeger. He's done a lot of good things.
He writes about, in his case, things about workers and homelessness and things like that.
Yeah.
And you seem to have that same take on things, maybe that deal with musicians and art and the way the world works and the universe and all that sort of thing.
That's certainly a sensible comparison, I think. You know, anybody who writes about society, the way society is going, you know, and makes social comments. I sort of share his sensibilities in a lot of areas, I'm sure.
And there's always the danger that if you make social comments, somebody's going to say, you're too political to live in America.
I always figured that for every dedicated fan, you have two enemies.
And you hope that they're not the stalker type. Yeah.
Because, see, when one person goes around talking about how great you are, there's three or four people that he knows that hate you. They get so tired of hearing him talk about you that...
I never thought of that, but that's about, as a matter of fact, the congressmen and the senators always say when they get one letter, they figure it's done the work of 10 letters. That's how they do their tables on things. And that's probably true. And the people that tend not to like things usually make their voices known more than the people that do.
Yeah.
Let's hear another piece of music here. We're going to go to a tune called Top 40. Why don't you set this up for us? Tell us a little about it.
That's a tune that I wrote 20 years ago, 25 years ago maybe, and I never did it. Until I got ready to make that record ever since the world ended. And I was looking for an up sort of tune that would lend itself well to an arrangement for two horns.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought of that tune, and it fit that criteria. And so I just did a little chart on it, and it turned out to be a real good vehicle for Benny Wallace and mm-hmm. John Mollick. Yeah. And Bob Mollick. And so it was, it worked out good, you know. So I started doing it. I don't do it a lot because it's got so many words. I have trouble. If you miss an entrance in that tune, you're lost. You know, it's got so many words. So I do it now and then, but it's just a comment on the music scene.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear it. Top 40.
When I make my top 40 big beat rock and roll record, everything is gonna be just fine. When I make my top 40 big beat rock and roll disc, I'll be the record company's Valentine. No more philosophic melancholia, 800 pounds of electric genitalia. When I make my top 40 big beat rock and roll record, everything is gonna be just fine. When I make my first tone wah wah synthesized record, everything is gonna be just grand. When I make my first tone wah wah synthesized disc, I'll have to get myself a moving band. Costume, hairdo, made up cute, a personal connection in a business suit. When I make my first tone wah wah synthesized record, everything is gonna be just grand. When I make my dynamite heavy soul freaked out record, everything is gonna be just swell. When I make my dynamite heavy soul freaked out disc, I'll be living it up pell mell. Mountaintop hideaway, three car garage, out there hustling that sonic massage. When I make my dynamite heavy soul freaked out solid gold top 40 big beat rock and roll record, everything is gonna be just fine.
Top 40 is now top 10 and used to be top 100, and the world changes, the musical world changes. How has the record business, the music business, how have you been treated? A lot of people have a lot of really bad and some good things to say about the music industry.
Yeah, well, the music industry is just like the rest of the country, and that is, it's more concentrated. There's a few people that make a fortune, and then there's a lot of good people that are scuffling to make a living. It's just like everything else that's happening. Wealth has become more concentrated in smaller areas.
That's right.
And so the music business is like that, and there's something going on in the music business I refer to as the Glitzkrieg. And if you can qualify for the Glitzkrieg, there are certain things that are required for you to get in the Glitzkrieg.
Well, let's hear what they are.
Well, the first thing is sex appeal.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is an ingratiating smile.
Mm-hmm.
The third thing is a little bit of talent. And the fourth thing is a knack for mediocrity.
I could add one more to that, and that is hair. You have to have the right hair.
Hair doesn't hurt you. Hair.
Yeah,
that's
right. You've got to have the
hair,
right hair.
I'll have to add that to
my
list.
Yeah, add the hair.
But anyhow, if you can qualify for the Glitzkrieg, you know, you can make a lot of money, you know, if you get the light, bright promotion and everything. But everywhere I go, there's a lot of real good musicians, you know, that are just getting by and they have to be real dedicated to survive. And a lot of times they have to do other things like teach and so forth in order to make it. So that's the way it is, you know. I think it's gotten worse in the last few years, but maybe it'll get better. Who knows?
Well, there's a thing going on in the music industry now that really worries me. I've talked to other musicians about it. That seems to be a trend, but this may be one of those leftover things from the 80s where everybody was spending as much as they could. But there's this trend among the big artists and the big companies to see how big the contract can be and how long it will take them to make the album. And they actually brag that it takes them a year and a half to make an album. And I'm saying, gee, guys, you can make an album in a week. You know, I mean, what's with it?
Every album I ever made was made in 2 or 3 days.
Yeah.
And
it seems backward to me. It seems like if you take a long time to make an album, it shows you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah, I can't imagine what anybody does for that long. I can't see what they do that long. But, I know what you mean. It's all, you know, that's excess. You know, excess is what it amounts to. I've always been sort of on the fringes of the music business. You know, I've never really been really in the music business. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of in the wings.
Well, we all, if we think real hard, we all try to stay out of the music business if we can to keep our sanity. Mm-hmm. But you have a very, very wide following, and you work a lot.
Oh, yeah, I have a dedicated group that like what I do, and thankfully, I managed to stay alive. You know.
Yeah. You work how often do you work?
Well, I work now about 125 nights a year.
Yeah.
I was working 200 nights a year back a few years ago, but I cut out some of the traveling, some of the one nighters. Mm-hmm. So now I work about 125 nights.
Mm-hmm. Do you work in Europe?
I work in Europe. I was working in London every spring until the recent war. And
the recent war
stopped that for a year, but I'll be going back over in September. And I make occasional jaunts to Scandinavia, wherever. Mm-hmm. And I played a gig in Hong Kong a couple of years ago. So I get around some, but not most of what I do is mostly in the States.
Mm-hmm. How do you cope with the language barriers in terms of your idiom writing and the things that are contained in your lyrics?
When I got to Stockholm and I did... You call it jogging, and I call it running around, and there was complete silence. I couldn't figure it out. And then I found out that they don't have that expression there. So the next night, the club owner got up and explained it to them. After that, man, it was a big hit. But, you know, I had a couple of weeks before that, I had played the thing in Austin, Texas, and, of course, the house came down,
you know.
And so it was really funny, you know, when I got so that happens, you know. And that's one of the reasons I don't play Europe more, you know. Mm-hmm. And I even had problems in Montreal, you know, because a lot of people most people speak French there. And one night, somebody was trying to translate the songs into French in the front row, and they said, oh, forget it, you know. Because, you know, there's idioms, and there's Southern expressions and things, and there's little ironies that, unless you know the language, you're not going to, you know. I always tell everybody it took 10 years before they started understanding me here.
Right. So it'll take another 10 over there.
So I do really well in England, you know.
Yeah.
They get it there.
Yeah.
You know.
Do you like the English audiences?
I've been doing real good there. I have a lot of fans in England. You know, I have a lot of musician friends there.
Yeah. I have been active in the country music business in days gone by, and I've played with a lot of musicians that have worked in England. And they seem to like American music a lot.
Oh, yeah.
But especially the regional kind of stuff, the Southern and the the country and that sort of thing. I get this mental picture of these very proper people in three-piece suits holding a teacup singing, you call it jogging, I call it running around.
Yeah, well, it could happen. The one place I played, I've been playing a place called Pizza on the Park, which is, was a real expensive supper club. And it did have a pretty elegant clientele for the most part. But I will be playing a different place this fall, I think, that's a little more affordable. I get more of my real fans
in. Your real fans, yeah. How about listening to Trouble in Mind?
Sure, yeah.
Right. Why don't you set this up for us?
Well, everybody knows that song, and it's an old song, and I never did consider singing it until I found some supplementary verses.
And I always wondered about that, because it seemed very short, but it's a great song.
Right. Well, you know, the original verses are sort of depressing, you know, like I'm going to kill myself. But then I found out, I looked at the song, and there are actually some extra verses which turn it into a completely different thing. Like, I mean, make it a satirical turn at the end where I'm going to lay my head on a lonesome railroad track, and when I hear the whistle blowing, you know I'm going to jump right back. And so that gave it an entirely new complexion as far as I'm concerned. So then I decided to sing it.
Yeah. All right. Here's Trouble in Mind.
Trouble in mind. I'm blue. But I won't be blue always. 'Cause the sun gonna shine in my back door someday. I'm going down to the river. I'm gonna take along my rocking chair. And if the blues don't leave me, I'm gonna rock on away from here. Well, if you see me laughing, Well, I'm talking about my worried mind. You know I'm not really laughing. I'm just trying to keep from crying. I'm gonna lay my head on some lonesome railroad track, and when I hear that whistle blowing, you know I'm going to jump right back. I ain't no fool.
Trouble in Mind. Who do you listen to nowadays? When you go home and put your feet up and listen to a record just for fun, what do you listen to?
I turn on the FM radio in New York, and there's about six good stations.
Mm-hmm.
Running everything from jazz through classical and ethnic, whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one station up there, KCR, Columbia Station, that has special programs. They'll play 24 hours of Muddy Waters.
Mm-hmm.
Or they'll play 24 hours of Lester Young or something like that. And there's no place in the world where you can run across that.
That's right.
And so that's one of the reasons I stay in that area, just because the music's so good on the radio. And so that's all. I don't buy records. I don't look for people, you know, nothing anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I just turn on the FM and I go back and forth between the stations until I hear something I want to hear. And they have blues, special blues shows, special jazz shows, and then, of course, they play classical music that you'll never hear anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, anywhere else in the country you go, you're going to hear Beethoven, Mozart, and the Brahms and so forth all day. But they play some people you'll never hear of anywhere else, and they'll never be played anywhere else, you know.
Right,
so,
right.
So that's what I do usually when I'm home, you know, just mm-hmm. listen to FM every afternoon, you know, see which station I want to hang with.
Mm-hmm. Does it seem to you, because we've all lived through the 60s, those of us of a certain age,
yeah.
as they say. I was listening to some of your music this morning before I came to the interview, and I was listening to How Much Truth Can a Man Stand?
Mm-hmm.
And the last line, Destined for the Frying Pan, which
yeah.
In a way is a cynical take on things, but it's also a very truthful,
right.
clear-eyed take. Does it seem to you, with what's going on in the world, that we're living 1965 and 66 all over again? I saw the newsreels last week, I just thought,
well, now that particular line, a lot of people think that line refers to the biblical ending fire thing, but it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
That line, I got the idea for that line by going to the Boston Planetarium and seeing a show where when the sun starts swelling up, it showed the skyline of Boston bursting into flames when the sun reached a certain point, which is what, you know, astronomers mm-hmm. say is going to happen. You know, now it might be millions of years away, or it might be tomorrow. But anyhow, that's where that line came from, because, you know, according to all of the scientific evidence, the sun will swell up one of these days
mm-hmm.
and the earth will be burned to a crisp. So that's what gave me the idea for that line. Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing about are we going through the 60s again? You know, remember the Aztecs and the Incas with the human sacrifices? That's the way this society works, human sacrifice.
That's right.
We ignore a problem no matter how obvious it is, no matter how flagrant it is. We ignore it until people are killed. Sometimes thousands are killed, sometimes four people are killed, but anyhow, we wait for somebody to get killed. And then maybe we do something about it, maybe not. But that's sort of, so it looks like what just happened is essential to this system. You know, it's like we require human sacrifice before we act on anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the people die, then this guy's coming out saying, "Wait, I told you this was going to happen, man. Remember, I sent you a memo about this 3 years ago, and you were at a banquet."
And then he disavows yeah. any knowledge of it, and then everybody
yeah, right.
goes to court, right?
Yeah, everything that happens, you know, the shuttle disasters, everything, you know, like everybody knew that it was going to, you know, somebody knew it was going to happen. Somebody told everybody it was going to happen.
Sure.
But they don't do anything about it until people are killed. So I say, you know, that's how we work, you know, on a human sacrifice.
Yeah. Does it seem to you that artists, writers, performers like yourself have to sort of get in there in a musical way and take up the slack where the press leaves off.
Oh,
because the press...
The press is used to be a counterbalance to all this, and now the press is part of it.
That's right.
The press folded up completely. They folded up completely, man. They just became, you know, like bought and sold, you know, like part of the advertising world, you know. So, yeah, you know, the funny thing about it is, it's the comedians, the young comedians are doing a lot. If I want to hear a social comment that I think is pertinent and really fresh and something that needs to be said, there's a lot of young comedians around that are doing that.
That's true. Mm. That's true. Yeah. Over the years, it seems maybe in every major revolutionary happening in any country that the artists and the musicians were the ones that were first to notice what was wrong and say something or sing something or paint something about it. But to that extent, do you feel an obligation to be sort of a philosopher, or does it just sort of come out of your music as...
It just, you know, I think it's necessary to say what you feel about things, you know, in some way. You don't have to say it out direct, and you don't have to propagandize, you don't have to shout at anybody, but that's one of the functions of a person who does what I do, and that is, I think you want to try to come up with some truth, you want to say something that's relevant, and you want to say something that'll make people think, and you feel like, you know, I've had people to tell me that they considered some of my songs as therapeutic, which I consider a great compliment, because a person, you know, you're always hoping that what you're doing is worth doing, is worthwhile, not only to yourself. I mean, I know it's worth doing to me because I enjoy it, and I get something out of it, and I get a lot out of it, but, you know, we all have the desire to be, to do something useful, you know, I think. Of course, you know, I've got a song about that. Am I trying to serve the human race, or am I just along for the ride? So it all comes out in the songs eventually.
Yeah. And the nice thing about your music is that while we're getting the message, we're also having a heck of a good time.
I like to swing it.
Yeah. And if you, you said one time, I only know two songs. One is the blues and the other one is not.
Something like that.
I wanted to quote for the audience one other thing that I had heard you say on an interview show that I loved. We talked about mixing up the boogie with the do-si-do and the country music thing, but you said, quote, "I'm trying to unite New Orleans in Vienna."
Yeah, right.
And that seems a really nice way to think.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things I said. It's a joke. It'll probably end up as a song.
Well, it probably should end up in a book of quotations because it's a very nice one. You take the music and the message and where you're from and where you're going and put them all in a piece of music that people can enjoy and sit and drink a beer with.
That's the main thing, I think.
That's the main thing. We'll go out with Josephine here. But again, I wanted to say that my guest this evening has been the very wonderful Mose Allison. I have been extremely happy to have you here. So, good evening to everybody from Improvised Thoughts. We're going to go out now with Mose singing Josephine, and I'll see you next week.
Well, there never was a girl I could love like I love my Josephine. She's the flirt, she's the scamp, she's the vampiest vamp I have ever seen. Seems to me that she's always flirting with the fellas passing by. But when I say she winks, then she tells me that she thinks there's a cinder in her eye. Do you believe it? Well, I know it would be better if I go away and forget her. Everybody says it would be wise. But when I go out dancing with somebody else, I find myself dancing with tears in my eyes, because there's nobody quite so nice that could be quite so mean as that girl. What a girl, Josephine. Thank you. nobody quite so nice that could be half as mean. And that girl, what a girl, Josephine, Miss Josephine.